And eventually my mom had to send me away from New York for a while until things died down because there was a death threat for me. So I was sent to Florida again to live with my uncle for the next 2 years before I can actually return, which I later found out that the gang leader was murdered and a few other people went off to jail and so forth. My mom knew friends that were in the law enforcement at that time. So she got enough information to know when it was safe for me to come back.
This show is brought to you by Hospice Chaplaincy, promoting excellence in spiritual care at the end of life. For more information, please visit www.hospicechaplaincy.com. You are listening to the Hospice Chaplaincy Show, a show where we talk about the psycho-spiritual and psychosocial aspects of end-of-life care. You can find our podcast everywhere you get your podcasts. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please don't forget to give us your feedback by writing a review on iTunes and any platform you listen to the show from. And now, here are your hosts, Joe and Saul.
Thank you very much for joining us on this episode of the Hospice Chaplaincy Show. We have Chaplain Derek Hall zooming in from California. Derek, welcome to the show.
It's nice to be here.
Could you give us a little background of your childhood?
Well, let me see. I was born in England, Manchester, England, born to 13 children. With my parents, and I am the seventh boy, and I'm the 13th child. I grew up in a home where my mom had to flee from my dad because there was domestic violence in our home. And then I was brought to Jamaica to be with another family member, and that's where I stayed for a while. Things were kind of rocky there, and so eventually I got an opportunity to go back to England where I met my real dad. When I met my dad at that time, it was a scary moment for me because I got a taste of what my mom was talking about with his relationship. And I went to school in England for about a year and a half. After that, my uncle came for me and then I traveled back to Florida. That was another situation that a lot of abuse was in that family. And I believe that the grandmother, which I call grandma anyway, in spite, never really welcomed me into the family. They only had one daughter and they felt that all the money and the clothing and food, everything should go to that daughter, not to me. And I've been abused by her several times where she hit me in my head with her shoes and almost split my skull. And there was just a lot of things that were going on. And then one day my sister, I didn't know I had a sister at the time, but I had an older sister. She was the first of the family and I'm the last. And she came looking for me, and that's how she brought me from Florida to New York City. In New York City, that's where I met my mom. And we started off rocky. She wasn't really in the home a lot, so I started running in the streets. It's there I learned how to not be the nice guy. I don't like to talk about it much, but let's say, for instance, if you don't have a mother and a father in the home, it can be very difficult for a child. And when your mother's traveling a lot and don't pay much attention to you, because she also has her crisis and her drama and her trauma as well, it's very difficult for a young boy to grow up in a situation like that. So I started running around with the gang and they became my family and I was their family. And I believe that God had a calling on my life for a reason, because there were certain path I would not go down. And I don't like to talk about it, but there were certain things that I know I couldn't do, where there's rape and robbery and stuff like that. I was good at trying to rob somebody, but didn't really feel good about it. But you felt they were your family. It's interesting when folks say to themselves, why would kids do something like that? What are they thinking? But, you know, there's a lot of emotion and a lot of things that are tied up in that.
How did you really survive under, I mean, it's just so foreign to me to hear you say, I met my mom. I met my dad.
You're right.
How, my gosh, how does that affect you? How does that fit into your whole life?
Well, let's put it this way. When I met my dad, there was something that moved in me to say to myself, at least I can identify myself with someone. that I look at this man and I'm looking in his face and I'm talking to him. I said, wow, this is my dad. But my dad was not a person that emotionally connected with me, so to speak.
Right.
He came and left, came and left. And I was kind of thirsting for that father and son relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And even though I saw an abusive side of him, and even though I was fearful, I knew that the life that some ways in how I lived my life, I figured that as a dad, he could turn my life around. But he didn't invest himself in me. Mm-hmm. And that in itself was disappointing. And I made a pact with myself that if I should ever have children in my life, that that I would be there for them, that I would never abandon them. That was something that I swore to myself at the age of 11, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to be like him.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be like him.
That was a good decision. So at what age did you join the gangs?
It was actually the age of 12.
And that was when you're in New York?
Yes, New York. Yeah, coming to New York, you know, New York is what you really call a jungle. You get into New York, and the thing about it is that you don't get to join the gang willingly. I think they know how to detect when children are lost, when no one is looking out for them. And they have such a bewitching way about them that makes them feel that they love you and you are one with them. And you get so mesmerized by that doctrine, so to speak, that you really think you're one of them and you don't need anybody else. So my survival begins with them. They got my back. So if I'm in trouble at school and somebody's trying to beat me up, and if I went and said, hey, Pete, man, I'm having trouble in school, man, this guy is bullying me, then you'll find the whole pack comes and they're fighting for you. So when they do that, it does something to your psyche because you never had a defense from your mother. You never had a defense from your father. But these individuals, you're young and these are adults that are grooming you. You begin to look at them in a way that they are your fathers, so to speak.
So what did they expect from you in return?
Nothing good. They expect me to rob. I remember a situation where we were walking down Empire Boulevard and this woman was coming out of the bank, an elderly lady. And they had planned that since I was very good in school in track and field, of course, they wanted me to run, grab the bag, and then we'll meet at the corner of Fulton Street and we will split the money. And I remember when I was running, I took off. And as I was running, I remember saying, lady, they're trying to take your bag. Get back in the bank. But she wouldn't. She wouldn't do anything. And I noticed also that they were watching me. And I know if I didn't take the bag, I was going to get a whooping that day. Mm-hmm. And I kept trying to warn her and warn her, but she just, I guess she was just as scared as I was scared. And I grabbed the bag and I ran, but I did not have, I couldn't live it down. But that was one of the situations till there came a point in my life where that all changed. But
let me ask you, Derek, on that. That's a very, you know, you're very vibrant in your understanding, memory of that event.
Yes.
What did you feel when you were divvying up the money, when you were there with all the other people and you accomplished your goal, you took the bag, you ran off? How did you feel from the either accolades or good job or a pat on the back from your gang member friends?
It was actually mixed emotions. There were part of me that felt that when I did that, that the reward would be great, as you would want to hear from Father, good job.
Right.
And I told you D could do this, man, that guy's fast on his feet, you know, that kind of thing. But yet there was another side of me where I felt like this woman that I robbed was like a mom, like a mother figure.
Yeah.
And I was kind of wrestling with that. But as they were cheering me on, that began to sort of fade. It didn't give me a chance for it to settle, to differentiate between my wrong and right action, so to speak. So it was difficult, but on the other hand, I was happy that I accomplished because these guys have my back, but yet I was conflicted because I took something from someone that I didn't deserve to have. It was just I can't really explain more than that.
Okay. Mm. Did you happen to run into other members of your gang that had the same feelings that you had?
Sad to say, no.
Because it sounds like when they were, you know, giving you the, yeah, D can do this, blah, 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 he's fast, et cetera. They were trying to, they had no idea of your inner feelings or your own turmoil. And,
right.
They were trying to make you callous to the idea that this is just something that's how you're going to live life.
Right. That this was going to be the new normal, as they put the word today, right. The new normal. Because in a way, when they were giving me those accolades, a part of me wanted that. Wanted
sure.
that affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was another part of me. But the thing is, when they were doing that, everyone was rejoicing. Not one. You look around the room, everybody's happy because we're spitting up the money and some are going to go buy weed and some is going to buy a beer or whatever the case may be. So everybody's rejoicing off of, hey, you went and brought in the bread, brother.
Yeah.
You were the deliverer, so to speak.
So the sense of belonging, you know, that you were longing for to find at home, you found fully there.
Yes, I did. As sick as it may sound, at that time, being young, yes, that was family to me.
How long were you part of the gang?
For about 3.5 years.
Wow. Wow. How did you get out?
a good whooping.
really? Really?
Tell us more.
When someone was teaching me the Bible in church, and I began to understand the doctrine and understand a relationship with Christ, I even had a more deeper turmoil inside of me. I was really fighting with this. But on the other hand, I was so happy about the gospel, the way I heard it, I went to tell them the good news. Mm-hmm. it didn't come off too good. And so first they made mockery.
Ah, yes.
And that was the first thing they did. This Jesus, he's not going to put this money in my pocket and so forth. And they went on and on. And then when they realized I was very serious, that they looked, I believe the leader looked in my eyes and he realized this guy is serious, man. You know, and on top of that, I already know the hideout. I know everything about them. I know them by face. I know them by name. I know our secret places. And I guess at that point, you know, they decided, you know, he told them to explicit words to me. And so the fight was on. And I have two marks. My eyebrows don't cover completely the ones on the side, but they kicked me in the face. They kicked me in my stomach. They stomped me in my back. I mean, they beat me to the point where I believe they thought I was dead. Mm-hmm. They threw me in a garbage can and in a one of those big green metal boxes, left me for dead. I guess at the point they look at me, I wasn't breathing. And so it was that's why I said, it's interesting that even in my life when I was doing things, there was this homeless man that I knew and I would always talk with him and I sort of adopted him. And when I saw him, I call him daddy. So people would say, is he your real father? But I had a connection with this homeless man.
Right.
He was very nice to me. And for some reason, yes, he was smelly to other folks. But to bypass that, he came along looking in the dumpster, looking for something to eat, found me there. And I guess they called 911. And that's how I was discovered. And eventually my mom had to send me away from New York for a while until things died down because there was a death threat for me. So I was sent to Florida again to live with my uncle for the next 2 years before I can actually return, which I later found out that the gang leader was murdered and a few other people went off to jail and so forth. My mom knew friends that were in the law enforcement at that time. So she got enough information to know when it was safe for me to come back.
So Derek, what did those experiences teach you about life?
Well, one thing it taught me personally is perseverance, taught me survival. And another thing that it really taught me, which was very interesting, because in spite of what went down, I learned to become a more compassionate person, to listen to people, which I learned a lot. And in a sense, it helped make me a better person. I would say.
So what happened to the gang? Were they arrested?
Yeah, some were arrested for robberies. One was arrested for murder. The gang leader himself was murdered in prison, and quite a few of them dispersed. So that's what I learned when I came back. So yes, so they were no longer a threat to me, but I'm pretty sure word went out to not bother me at all from law enforcement. So, you know, but at this time I got a taste of my mother actually taking action in my life.
That's a very positive force. And that's, you know, hearing you talk, and you were trying to run into the idea of how was it you entered and found Christ in your life. I'd like to, again, back up to that again and start talking about you spent giving us the information about being in somewhat of an abusive household. And yes. How did you ever formulate, as I see now, especially when you gave the example of robbing that woman, and that internal turmoil you had, where did you find that passion, that compassion, after having been put in that situation, seems like for that, until that time in your life?
You know, it's interesting that you ask that question. You know, in spite of going through abuse in my childhood, from the time my mom had to escape my father up until New York, it has always been a way where God always have someone come to the house and ask, "Is okay if I take your son to church?" Mm. And things like that would happen periodically. And I think I got my first taste of that when I would hear preaching from the pulpit. I didn't understand it enough because I was young, but I knew it did something to me. And it did something to me in a way. And even though the family that I grew up were not religious, they never went to church. I honestly believe that is in hearing those things, or maybe seeds were planted in it consciously that I was not aware of, that begin to start germinating. You know, they say you preach the word, but wherever the seed falls, I think exactly. It started to fall in my life at some point that I really didn't understand how it was being engrafted in me. To the point that I was awakened consciously to things that were wrong and things that were right. And I think that's where that started with. But it didn't come from the home life, because in my home life, I experienced not only physical abuse, sexual abuse, verbal abuse. I mean, there were a lot of things that was happening to me as a young kid growing up. And I think that in itself has helped me to be the man that I am today, and to be more compassionate and to listen and to understand what other individuals are going through, because I've had a taste of something they may have experienced or something that I could bring to the table to say, well, there's hope.
How did you reconcile your childhood trauma with your faith that you were growing into?
You know, I think when I started going through those lessons and those studies, and I remember when the pastor was saying to me, you know, I want you to go home, you know, that's before baptism, I want you to go home, think about the things I talked about and pray about them and learn to forgive. It gave me took me down a road of forgiveness and so forth. And I think it's at that point I started thinking about my life and the things that I went through, and just, I guess I reached a point that, you know what? We're all humans. We all go through things. I don't know why things happened to me the way they did, but I was willing to forgive. I wouldn't say I reached the point of forget immediately, because there were times when there were triggers in my life when people would say things or do stuff that would trigger memories that I would go through, until as I was growing in my faith and a relationship with Christ, that I began to learn how to deal with that. And I did also seek professional help in dealing with those thoughts. I always tell people, Christianity is a good thing, yes, but when you really need help, there's a time when you really have to reach out, because it will help you in your spirituality. But the thing is, I was happy that I did find a way to talk things out from a professional level, to have good friends in my circle that are confidential and can know when I'm going through things or triggered and can help and so forth. But I think I reconciled when it came to the point of forgiveness, when I understood what forgiveness was, to release the other person, to free myself from that burden or whatever what was going on in my life.
At what point did you recognize your call?
You know, funny as it may seem, after my baptism and being in church, when they would ask me to read or to give a thought of my day, people would tell me, you know what? I believe the Lord has a call in your life to be a minister. I said, well, he may tell you that, but he hasn't told me anything. And so they would try to put me in front of the church to do little things. And after a while, I find myself running like Jonah. Mm-hmm. I try to run away from it. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that while I was in school, I took up drama, acting class, as well as music. And I won a lot of competition for my school, Wingate High School in Brooklyn. I was picked to go to Juilliard School of Music. And I believe that was a way of me not only acting, but things that I went through allowed me to put those feelings and emotions into my acting. I believe that at that point, I was trying to escape, but on the other hand, wanted to be a star, so to speak. Going back through that feeling, I need to be accepted. I wasn't accepted by my mom or my dad. So I'm just feeling maybe if I become a star, maybe if they could see me on the movie screen, or maybe I could have that latest album or so forth. But it turned out that that's not where God wanted me. I remember when Fame, there was a movie called Fame that came out. Mm-hmm. And Fame was starting a series. And so I auditioned for the series and I got accepted. Wow. And I remember getting up to get on the subway at 3 a.m. in the morning to go for a 5 a.m. shoot. Because a lot of people, when they look at movies, they think that when they see them, they shoot them like 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, right? Because they think they see the sun out. It must be a cool thing, but they don't realize to be an actor, you got to put in the work and you got to get up some real early hours to do it. And I remember while doing that, I was still studying and so forth, the Bible, and I don't know. As I began to think and rationalize about that, I said to myself, you know what? This may not be what God is calling me for, because there were certain parts in the scenes that I had to portray that I wasn't really comfortable with. And the reason why I wasn't comfortable with, because they were beginning to cause some type of trigger in my life. And so I sort of fell back from that. And there was a newspaper article that came out in the Daily News about a young man, myself, which I still kept, who left Fame for, what did it say? I left Fame for religion. Okay, I had an opportunity to sing for Arista Records. And there was a hit song that was to come out called Grounds for Divorce. And I remember rehearsing that song, but what changed my mind is when the producer sat beside me and was explaining to me about how he wants me to project this emotion, and he put his hand on my leg to explain, that was the end of the contract. I had a reaction, a stimuli, so to speak, meaning triggers. And I just got out of there. I mean, I batted out of there, and that was the end of that situation. So when I look back, I have to say I'm very happy that I did not become a part of that, because I've always wondered, interestingly, as I got in my late teens, I always wondered to myself that if I became a Christian, would I want something like that playing in the air, because I felt I'd have the guilt. I guess God knows our beginning and our end, but the truth of the matter, I'm happy that never came to anything, but I've had the opportunity of experiencing what it meant to be in the acting business and what it really means to be in the show business, so to speak.
Okay, with that, we'll take a little break and then we'll be right back.
Continuing to be a leader in the field of spiritual care at the end of life, Hospice Chaplaincy provides high-quality professional development webinars that will improve your practice of spiritual care at the end of life. Check out our latest webinars at www.hospicechaplaincy.com.
This is Ole Bem, and you're listening to the Hospice Chaplaincy Show. We are continuing our conversation with Derek Hall. Derek, could you give us your call to hospice chaplaincy?
Well, my call to hospice chaplaincy actually happened through law enforcement. I've been a law enforcement chaplain for 5 years, going on six. I believe it was through that another chaplain saw a gift in me. She felt that God was calling me to hospice. Hospice was something new to me, especially the word hospice. And I've always heard of military chaplains, hospital chaplains, but I've never really heard of hospice chaplains, much less law enforcement chaplains. But eventually, she set up an appointment for me to do that. And this is history. And that's how I really became a hospice chaplain, a hospice bereavement chaplain as well, doing both.
So you said you work as a hospice chaplain and then a bereavement counselor for your hospice?
Yes, I play both roles from the beginning to the pre. I do the pre-bereavement also along with what I do to the final bereavement.
And you say you're doing law enforcement now. Are you still doing law enforcement as well as hospice?
Believe it or not, yes. Because I do hospice 5 days a week, but sometimes on call, depending on if the patient is imminent, and they need me there, then it's usually 5 days a week. And then on the weekends, especially on Sundays, every Sunday, I put myself in to be out in the field. I always felt that I never bite the hand that feed me, so to speak. They have been the one that played a very important role in my life, who molded me and helped me to be where I am. So I've always feel like always giving back to those that have given to me. That's just something that was never really taught to me, but something for some reason God has placed in me. So I just love to give back to those that have given to me.
You spoke earlier, of course, about your upbringing. And when you're dealing with folks who are in the midst of the dying process and you start talking to them and you pray with them and you find out some intimate details of their life, does that do any triggers for you in your ministry?
At this point, no. In my life so far, I've come to peace with my upbringing, but when they speak of what they're going through, it helps me to not only listen, but to have a compassionate ear and to work alongside them to help them get through whatever they're going through, whatever guilt they may be going through.
Yeah.
Like, for example, there was a patient that I met. And she has two children, a son and a daughter. She wasn't really in their life a lot. And when she was dying, she finally told them the truth that she was dying. And so when they came into her life, she said she's a Christian. You know, when she called me for spiritual care, she really wanted me to spend more time doing her devotion. And so I would always go through a life review with her, you know, talk about
sure.
her.
Yeah.
Tell me something about yourself, your family. And so we discussed that. And so I realized that she was carrying this guilt. And I knew that she wanted to make recompense for her life. And so as she was talking and she told me she was a Christian, she said, but my daughter, she just won't accept Christ. I keep telling her about Christ and so forth. So then I began talking to her about, but does she know you as her mother? It's one thing to say you know God, but does she know the real mother, you know? And she puzzled with that for a moment. I says, so she told me that the daughter was, she invited the daughter and the daughter would be coming the Wednesday. So we talked a little bit and I gave her some tools. I said, do me a favor. When your daughter arrives, touch her. Let her feel the warmth of your hand. Engage her. Get to know her. Hmm. I'm not saying deny your faith, because if you're a Christian, you're going to live that life. So regardless, she'll see who you are. And if what you profess, she'll see that too. But she needs her mom. She doesn't want Jesus. She haven't gotten her mom. She's all she's hearing is Jesus, Jesus, but not mom. And so she paused for a moment. She is like, she went back in her head and she's like, I never really looked at it that way. I say, yes, if you could just reach out. And so I gave her some tools. And on our next visit, she began to explain how she did that, how she reached out to her daughter. And for the first time, her daughter cried and said, Mom, you finally let me know that you care about me. Mm. And so after a while, they began to build their relationship. And her daughter was able to forgive her. And she was able to die in peace, knowing that the reconciliation was there. The same thing that happened with her son, you know, with the estranged relationship with the husband and everything that was going on, the children were left out. And so we go into her life review, we talked about different ways of how we can do that. And eventually she tried to bring Jesus up in the story. And that was her biggest thing. Well, she didn't accept Jesus. And I says, you know what? You planted the seed. That's what you did. You planted a seed. And I was talking from my own experience. You plant a seed. Don't just be happy for her that she now has her mom back.
I like what you did there, because sometimes people are so heavenly bound that they're utterly irrelevant. So exactly. What you did is you called her to her own humanity.
Yes.
And when she embraced her own humanity, she was able to relate with her kids on human terms. And that is such a powerful quality that sometimes people who are spiritual miss, because it's always, I think it's easier to hide behind the scriptures and all the religious credo and forget our humanity.
Yes.
And I thought that was really powerful.
Which is easier, hospice or law enforcement? Hospice. I mean, ministry.
I would say hospice is a lot. Hospice would be a lot easier. And I'll tell you why. Because in law enforcement, you are called out to do death notifications. You're sometimes called out because of suicide. You're called out because there's been a traumatic situation where there's an accident. And I'll give an example. The hardest part for me, especially when it comes to law enforcement, is when I was brought on a scene. This was a scene that it was on the national news. I won't say anything more than that because of the confidentiality of that. But I was called to a scene where a mother, her son, who is an attorney, murdered his fiance and killed himself. And I remember when called to the family's home, and as they let me through the door, there was this eerie feeling. They let me through the door, and I came in a beautiful home, a mansion, district attorney, wonderful mansion. And so when I went in and I got in, I saw the family all together, and the mother kept saying, is he alive or is he dead? He's alive or is he dead? And they said, she's been saying this for the longest. But I knew that the mother was in shock. And so as I looked around the room as they were talking, because, you know, they didn't really know what to do. And I was just praying in my mind and trying to figure out a way how I could help. And so as I looked around the room and I saw a picture, a family picture. I saw a family picture. And then I saw a picture of her and her sons alone. Don't ask me why I chose that picture. So I said, could you take that picture down from the wall for me for a moment? He said, okay. So they passed the picture to me and I said, can I sit beside her? And I sat beside her and I put the picture in her hand, the frame in her hand. And as she was holding and said, is he dead? is he alive? And say her name is Mary. I said, Mary, my name is Chaplain Derek. Could you do me a favor? And she looked at me. Yes. I said, which one is your son? Which one, Mary, died? Show me which one died. And she pointed actually at the son who died. And so I said, could you tell me something about him? And that kind of took her off for a moment. And she talked about when he was first born. And she gave me this story, which really kind of took the pressure off of her mind as she was telling this. And so when she finished telling the story, she went back again. Is he alive? And so eventually what had happened is that as I begin to help her process and talk about it, eventually she stopped for a moment and started now looking at her husband, which she said she hadn't done for a while. And she hugged him and she started rubbing his back and told him, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And as she said that, I turned around the room and I looked at everybody and says, this is the time to come and hold her. And so when they come, they say, Mom, we're here. And they begin to hold her. Things began to change. But of course, eventually she went back. But before leaving, what I loved is that eventually she began to sort of talk more with her husband and talk more with her children. And so eventually I tell him, professional, she would definitely need to have help. They called for the doctor that was gave her Valium and so forth to help calm her down, to calm her mind down, because it was at a pace and I really needed her not to, you know, you can really go into shock. And so eventually I saw where that helped. But I left that scene with that thing on my mind that was so worried about her. You know, that I was almost taking that home, taking that home with me to the point that I too myself had to sit down and talk, sure. Which I love with law enforcement to do a debrief on that.
But hearing your story and then knowing my stories I have with families, we do the same thing, but not under such chaotic time frame as a death situation such as that. I mean, I've walked into families that the patient looks at you and says, yeah, I know I'm dying, but everybody else around him is in such denial that they don't even allow that person to talk about it. And that gives me the same impression as to how that lady was responding to her death of her son. And you know, it's a different situation, but it's the same situation. I mean,
same intensity. It's grief.
Yes, it's really grief. And it's not until I asked them to send for the other son in the picture that when he arrived, was able to really reach her. She could identify another son. Before, she couldn't see anyone. But when that son walked through the room and he walked in, when I asked to send for him, when he walked in the room, he was the one who could really touch her.
Right.
Every hospice chaplain that comes on the show tell us how much they love what they do. Why do you love hospice chaplaincy?
Oh, I love hospice chaplaincy for the fact that I love people. I love coming along the side of individuals that, especially in hospice, that sometimes when they get a diagnosis, they feel so alone. Many times family members don't realize that the one who is dying is even grieving more than the ones that are alive because they're not going to be there anymore. And it's good when you can come alongside with them and they can be their true self, something they can't do with their own family. They can do with you. They can be more open without judgment or any stigma to whatever they're saying. You know, like for example, there's a family who is a Christian family and they want their brother who is dying. I mean, the guy is dying and they're arguing over he needs to be in their faith. And so he talked about Baby Ruth. He wants to go to heaven where he can play baseball with Baby Ruth, right? And that was his spirituality, right?
Sure.
And I tried to explain to family, who are we to judge that? You know, this is who he is and this is what he wants. And I need for him to be okay with what he wants, the way he wants to go out, the way he wants to live his life in his last days. And so with the family, I gave them this story. I think this is what kind of calmed them down. I said, you guys are religious, right? I said, you remember the story about the rich ruler, how he came to Jesus and he said to him, you know, I kept all your commandments. You know, I don't steal. I don't commit adultery, blah, blah, blah. And then Jesus said to him, well, okay, since you do all of that, sell your goods and come follow me. And the Bible said that the rich ruler turned away sadly, right? Mm-hmm. Left his way. So then I said to them, now, did Jesus turn around and said to the rich ruler, do you know who I am? Do you know I'm the Son of God? You're going straight to hell. Just for doing that, you're going straight to hell. All right? Did you see anywhere in scripture where he was demeanored or put down or condemnation was put upon him? No. And so we have to learn by Christ's example. You've got to learn to first be compassionate to the human being, accepting them first as a human being. You can't judge them based on just because they don't want what you have, that somehow something is wrong with them. And so after a while, they kind of backed up. They said they never looked at it in that light. And I says, you never know the fruits, that the seeds that you sow, what can happen. But if you keep coming at him like that, it's not going to happen. And finally, I had a moment with him before he died. He confessed to me in a way that his family members were hypocrites, that they'd say one thing, but they were doing another thing and so forth. And that's why he really didn't want to be. And he was the one that opened the door to me by saying, but I believe you're a man of God. How can I accept Jesus as my personal Lord and Savior? That's without them ever being in the room. And so it's very interesting that even in chaplaincy, what I love is that you meet people's needs. You don't proselytize, you don't preach at them, but if they, whatever door they open, whatever door they give you permission to walk into, then you walk into that world. If they close that door, you have no right or no permission to kick that door down forcefully to do whatever you want. The agenda should never be you. And what I love about chaplaincy, hospice chaplaincy, is that I'm always behind the scene. I'm the ministry of presence. I don't need to be in the forefront. I always tell people, when you're going to chaplaincy, if you're looking for accolades or you're looking to be in the forefront, you're in the wrong place. If you love, you accept, and you give and you believe in humanity, then this is the place to be.
I you know, Derek, I am so impressed with your ability to share the story, but I also am very impressed with how you have a presence of just listening and being able to evaluate the situation. And really, that is a gift from God, because you're listening there, you're in the midst of all kinds of confusion, whether it's law enforcement or hospice, right? And you have to listen and hear what God is saying to you and what you need to do. Sure, you have a lot of experience and you have an enormous ability to integrate that into everything that you do. I thank you for being here, but I don't have any more questions. I just want to acknowledge how I think you are just doing very great work, and thank you.
So how are you, just one, how are you dealing with the pandemic right now?
You know, the pandemic at this point can be a little rough on us as chaplains, because we are personable. You know, we're people to people, so to speak. And but it's difficult, especially when family members have the opportunity of either looking through the window or you're working behind the scenes to try to help them. Let me give a perfect example. There's this couple, they've been married for 65 years. They promised each other that they would die together, or if one was dying, they would be there. And so in this pandemic, he's dying. He's having these breaths, and she wants to be in the room with him. And she gives this beautiful story about their relationship. Well, it took a lot of work to go in and talk to the director and say, listen, could you please allow this wife to be with her husband, because he was having difficulty passing. You know, you know, as they say, they're waiting on someone.
Right, right.
They're holding out for someone. I honestly believe that he was holding out for his wife. And so we were able to arrange it. And so she got in the room with him. And did you know when she laid beside him and said, "Baby, I'm here. I'm here, honey. I'm here." And she took his hand and put her hand in his, and she kissed him on the forehead. And she curled up into a fetal position beside him. Did you know, I would say probably less than 60 seconds, he gave up the ghost. Yeah. He went to sleep.
Yep.
She didn't even realize that he had slept until I said to her, "He's gone." The nurse had to come in and do everything. And that's when they realized he was gone. So it's, you know, this pandemic, as bad as it may seem, in some ways, I thank God in chaplaincy that in some ways we are like a vehicle to helping family members sometimes get to tie the knot, either by interacting or by what we use, like our cell phones, like what do you call it? Sometimes we can Zoom, or sometimes we can
telehealth,
FaceTime, or
FaceTime.
Right. So right, telehealth. So that's how we do it. But I was very, very happy to have participated in a time like that to bring that closure between the couple.
Derek, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you for listening. And always know that I am very happy to be among comrades that love what they do. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to know that as chaplains, we are people too. We go through life with pain and joy, just like anyone does. But the most important thing is we love on those who we come in contact with. And we are that ministry of presence to take them through that journey and to know they're never alone, that we will always be there with them if no one else is.
That was Chaplain Derek Hall. Thank you for listening.
Podcasting in Joliet, Illinois. Audio Hive Podcasting is a studio dedicated to podcast recording, editing, and production. For more information, you can find us at audiohivepodcasting.com.